15, Norwich solicitor struck off for defrauding his clients. Our historian tells the story of how Isaac Bug Coke's comeuppance was many years in the making.
Back in the 19th century, Mr. Isaac Bug Coke's was a prominent Norwich solicitor, numbering major local figures among his clients, including A.J. Cayley, the mineral water magnate, and Sir Robert Harvey, the banker. It was to be in connection with the latter's estate that Croakes was to incur the displeasure of the Law Society, leading to his being struck off the rolls. But his comeuppance was a long time in the making. Harvey committed suicide in 1870, but it was nearly 30 years later before Coke's faced 8 charges of professional misconduct in connection with his handling of Harvey's estate. Coke's had an unusual background for a professional man in the more structured social system of the time. He was born plain Isaac Bug, the son of the village carpenter, in Brundle. He must have been a man of considerable intelligence, vaulting ambition, and great persistence to reach the station in life which he achieved. On the way, he married a Miss Fussy, who subsequently enjoyed an inheritance from her uncle, a Mr. Coke's. Whether as a requirement of receiving the bequest or simply as a token of gratitude to the benefactor, Bug decided to add the name Coke's to his own. The qualities which enabled him to climb the ladder stood him in good stead when he reached the top. He was imaginative, acquisitive, and ambitious. He was also greedy, devious, and not constrained by any inconvenient moral code. As a result, he became an extremely wealthy man, owning, amongst much else, about 14 acres in Thorpe Hamlet, which he developed for housing. He named 6 of the roads he built after the 6 daughters that he had with the former Miss Fussy: Beatrice, Florence, Primrose, Marion, Ethel, and Ella. His wealth was to survive his later disgrace. Sir Robert Harvey committed suicide when it became clear that his decade-long misappropriation of customers' money to fund his own speculative investments was going to bring down the bank. Those investments had turned sour with the approach of the Franco-Prussian War. He didn't make a very good job of it, shooting himself on July the 15th, 1870, but taking 3 days to die. The bank closed immediately, and the speed with which developments occurred would astonish anyone familiar with the banking crises of recent years. The Gurneys, having heard a rumour of Harvey's suicide, the same afternoon sent a servant to Harvey's home at Crown Point to inquire, but he was turned away. The news wasn't delayed long, though. At 5 a.m. the following day, a messenger arrived at Samuel Gurney Buxton's home at Catton Hall in the middle of a crashing thunderstorm to report that Harvey had smashed. Within an hour, Buxton had met with his partners and was on his way to London to pick up the pieces. The source for this tip-off? Isaac Bug Coke's. The same morning, the Gurneys offered to advance up to 50% of their deposits to the 3,000 customers affected by the crash. Bankruptcy petitions were filed against the dying Harvey and his 2 innocent partners the same day. 2 days later, on the day of Harvey's death, the Times announced that the Gurneys had taken over the assets and liabilities of Harvey's Crown Bank. The price was £42,000, half of which was for the goodwill. With whom did they negotiate? Well, Isaac Bug Coke's. In the archives of Barclays Bank, I found a letter signed by him acknowledging the £21,000 paid for the goodwill. Coke's was by this time working with the trustee in bankruptcy, a Mr. Bailey, apparently appointed despite a commercial relationship with one of the largest creditors. So who recommended him? Isaac Bug Coakes. It would seem that the activities, or at least the fees charged for them by Coakes, were raising corporate eyebrows. There were some rumours at a creditors' meeting held a few months later, but more specific was a handwritten note, again held in the Barclays archive, from the commissioner in bankruptcy, listing a series of payments made to Coakes by the Gurneys, questioning what these payments were for. Frustratingly, I could find nothing in the archive to suggest what conclusion had been arrived at by the commissioner in respect of these payments. But if there were questions about the level of fees charged by Coakes, these faded into insignificance when compared with the games he got up to in dealing with Harvey's assets, a number of which he acquired. It was one asset in particular which eventually led to his being struck off. Robert Harvey had two younger brothers, one of whom, John, was of weak mind and was looked after at his home at Farston Hall by an attendant described rather unkindly in White's Directory of 1854 as servant to the idiot. The other was Edward Kerrison Harvey, EKH, who was born with a medical condition, and to provide for him, their father had set aside a large sum as a life interest, enough to produce an income of £13,000 per annum, and that's probably in excess of £1 million today. On Edward's death, the capital would revert to Robert, but Robert bought out his brother's life interest for cash for £60,000, less than 5 years' income, and this was an asset purchased by Coakes and others for £40,000 on Harvey's death. It was to prove the root of Coakes's problems. Resolving the Harvey estate issues proved a long and wearisome task. A final dividend was paid to creditors after 10 years. They wound up with about 70% of their money returned. After this length of time, there were complaints and rumours about how the process had been managed, and one pair of creditors took Coakes to court about his acquisition of this particular asset. The case was to rumble on for years, with decisions first in favour of Coakes, reversed on appeal, followed by a hearing in the House of Lords, which restored the original decision in Coakes's favour. It subsequently became known that the plaintiffs had turned down an offer of £30,000 before the case went to the House of Lords. About 12 years after the original action had been instigated, the case was reopened on allegations of fraud and thrown out by the judge as being vexatious. Coakes sought to prevent an appeal, but the House of Lords did not accept his argument, though the subsequent appeal was dismissed. However, the trustee in bankruptcy brought his own case against Coakes, and the latter gave up some of the purchases he had made. In August 1896, 26 years after Harvey's death, and 16 years after the case had first been heard, the matter was closed when the Law Society made a report to the House of Lords, which, having heard its contents, caused the Lord Chief Justice to determine that the court would be failing in its duty if it did not, in the most emphatic way, mark its sense of the scandalous story disclosed in this report, and ordered that Coakes be struck off the rolls. If you've managed to plough through all that, 26 years of litigation in a few paragraphs, you might agree with me that the only true winners were the dozen or so QCs and their assistants who drew their fees. The fraud had involved not just Coakes, but also a Mr. Bunyan, the actuary of the Norwich Union. To purchase the life interest on EKH from the estate, Coakes had sought a loan from Norwich Union, who required a policy on EKH's life as security. It transpired that they had conspired to mislead the court by arranging life assurance at a higher rate than EKH's health actually demanded, implying a shortened life expectancy and thus ensuring that the price of their purchase was lower than it should have been. In fact, EKH lived for a further 30 years, during which Coakes and his associates drew about £390,000. They were also said to have bribed an alternative bidder to desist. The enormity of this fraud was reported elsewhere in the empire. The New Zealand Herald headlined its report, £470,000 for £40,000, one-time office boy's amazing coup. Coakes died in 1910, still a wealthy man. His estate was worth in excess of £400,000, that's more than £40 million today. Although he had had to return some of the assets he had derived from the estate, the income he had received from EKH's was not returned. He was certainly clever and cunning. He deployed several stratagems to blur the focus of the authorities and perhaps, ironically, was only finally stumped on evidence produced by a member of his staff who had first tried unsuccessfully to blackmail him before informing the court. It would be nice to conclude that he got his just desserts. Sadly, he got a lot more.